This is Jeff Phillips Weverson here on the beautiful island of Rarotonga, and I'm with Stan Wolfgram, a really awesome person who I've met yesterday, and he's given an hour of his time to share his background and special projects and love of this island. And Stan, thank you so much for your time.
Welcome to the Cook Islands, which actually is in the middle of the South Pacific. To get here is probably about 3.5 hours by airplane from New Zealand, and I think it's around 9 hours from LA. So we're quite smack in the middle of the South Pacific here.
It's an awesome place. The island's really captured my heart. I really was noticing it yesterday. I actually almost started getting a tear in my eye thinking about how much I missed it, and I hadn't even left yet. It's a beautiful place. All the people are extraordinarily lovely.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's ones that aren't, but I haven't met any of them yet.
Yeah. Yeah, well, each of the Pacific Islands are unique.
Yes.
There's over 1,000 islands throughout the whole South Pacific. We're in the Pacific Ocean, and we are the largest ocean in the world. Covers half of the world. And actually, for me, my mother is a Cook Islander.
Yes.
So she's from here. My father is a Tongan.
Yes.
From the island of Tonga. And I was actually born in New Zealand.
Yes. Did you ever live on Tonga?
Yeah, so I started going back to Tonga when I was 3 years old.
Yes.
My parents shifted back there when I was 17.
Yes.
So I would spend quite a bit of time going backwards and forwards to Tonga. As my parents have gotten older, they've started to spend a bit more time in the Cook Islands.
Yes.
So
where do they live mainly now?
It's between Tonga, New Zealand, and the Cook Islands.
Okay.
So they live between the three. They are a bit older now, so they're, because of medical, et cetera, they're spending a bit of time.
Are they just slowing down a little bit?
Yeah.
Wow. Well, that's good. Things aren't quite a blur. Things aren't as blurry when you're going a little bit slower.
Oh, yeah, no, they're, I think it's just that cycle of life. And so it makes us all aware of, maybe how fragile life is and how probably important it is to get on with a few things in life.
Absolutely. Well, there's a syndrome. I had a partner from Belgium for 5 years, and we traveled all over Australia and New Zealand, mainly by hitchhike, and we loved the beauty of nature. So occasionally a new place would come on our radar that we would fall in love with, and we go, oh my God, we got to go there. How are we ever going to do that? Mm. Like, for example, Hinchinbrook Island, and other places like that. And but this happened more than once. We would finally be on almost arriving at one of these destinations. It had taken us years to get there.
Yes.
And we'd be like maybe hitchhiking and riding with somebody that lived close to there.
Yeah.
And we'd say, hey, so how many times have you been to Hinchinbrook Island? They go, oh, well, we'll get there one of these years. And
yeah.
I go, what?
Yeah.
You live that close to this magnificent place and they've never been just because they can't.
Yeah, yeah.
Just because it's right there, they end up and then their life's over and they never did it.
Yeah.
So I'm like the exact opposite.
Yeah.
I try to do everything now. As much as you can.
Yeah, well, that's that thing of, living life. Do we live to work or do we work to live? So, that philosophy. And so, yeah, I think you're fortunate if you can, be in a position where you can live life to the fullest. And you say sometimes it's pretty much a matter of choice.
Exactly, and we make that ties in with one of my big philosophies of life. People, they see my art and they go, Jeff, I wish I was an artist. And I go like, well, you are.
Yeah.
Even if you haven't tried painting or writing or playing music, you are your own work of art, because art creative, to me, art is not so much about the artifacts that you create, but it's about your process of creativity and the choices you make. So the choices you make your whole life at all different levels and that you're making all the time, that's how you create who you are.
Yeah.
And whether you relinquish that to other forces outside you, and it's more complex than that, but we are creating ourselves.
Yeah, definitely. So I think maybe in environments like this in the Pacific, where we're less pressure on commercialism, et cetera,
yes,
that we have a little bit more freedom as far as the ability to make these choices as far as the direction of our life is concerned.
Absolutely.
So,
I find this place to be very inspiring. It's a great environment for me to be creative in and to just kind of like. I'm not really on holiday because I've got too much stuff to do, you know. But an environment where I can, you know, do my art and stuff reasonably undisrupted. And I like this climate too. I like warmth.
Yeah. And where I come from, I suppose, and where I work in that space. You know, one of the things we say, we talk about human nature.
Yes.
And so we talk about them as a fact of two separate entities, and a lot of people actually have lost touch with the nature side. So it's about the reconnection between human nature, human and nature.
That's a very good point. Mm. Well, so now, Stan, tell me about tell us about where we're sitting right now.
So we're sitting in a place called Te Ara, Cook Islands Museum of Cultural Enterprise. So it's a social economic development project, a model around a major issue in the Pacific and developing nations, and that's the issue of trade deficit. In the Cook Islands, we have approximately $140 million worth of imports and probably around about $30 million worth of exports. Because of that, we've become very reliant on external factors. There's less development internally as far as using local produce, etc., local knowledge. And a lot of money goes out of the economy.
Yes. Now, how does the telecommunications thing fit into that? Is that considered an import?
So for us on in the Cook Islands, we're a satellite link as far as telecommunications-wise.
Yes.
Satellite coming into the Pacific region now as fiber optic cable is coming into the region, which is a very important factor. It will change a lot of things as far as commerce is concerned, etc. But for us at Te Ara, our philosophy is around it's an opportunity for us to have our own voice in the Pacific region for once. Not for once, but if we can capitalize on it, we can have a strong voice globally coming out of the region, grassroots up.
So that's one of the sort of platforms that you're involved in with this. Would you call it an organization or a project or a...
So, we are a...
Are you an NGO?
No, we're not an NGO. We're private sector, actually.
Okay.
Well, we sit in as around social enterprise. We're entrepreneurial. We sit in that social enterprise sector.
Yes.
We're about... Our mission statement is around economic self-determination for Cook Islands peoples.
Yes.
We look at the issues around trade deficit, and what they do is they make us, as I said, very reliant on external factors. We want to be self-reliant. So we have a classroom upstairs where we teach business, but our philosophy around business and development, we have three pillars. The pillars are business acumen, the second one is culture community, and the third is the environment. And bringing the three together in balance, or trying to find a balance, is what we call sustainability.
Yes.
We look at a lot of other people and their models, they'll only factor in one of the pillars. And they look at the financial side, and they look at... So for us, we take a holistic approach to sustainability. In doing that, we this is a classroom upstairs. We teach business upstairs, and then from here we go downstairs into a marketplace. So not only do we teach around developing a product, but we actually put the product to market. So this goes to market. And then the third factor in business is the buyer. So we'll create an attraction for tourists. And that's the buyer that will come into the economy. They'll bring new money into the economy. So that's the business cycle around developing local businesses, economic self-determination. But also what that does is gives us the opportunity to educate visitors that come to the island.
Yes. Yes, I can see that. But an aspiring young person, for example, that wanted to have a business here sometime, would they come to you for guidance or counseling or direct assistance somehow? Are you view that kind of thing?
Yeah. So we're an organization that offers that type of service. There are other agencies that do so, same thing.
Would you loan them money to start their business?
We loan them money.
No, I'm just kidding.
No. At the end of the day, this is where the business acumen side comes in.
Yes, they have to do that part themselves.
Yeah, well, In the region, there's a lot of players that are in the region, and they're here with different agendas.
Yes.
So they all vary anything from local government, regional government, NGOs, etc., corporations.
Who are some of those bigger players that are active here?
So there'll be anything from the local government agencies, which is the Business Trade and Investment Board locally,
yes,
the local Chamber of Commerce, the Ministry of Finance, etc.
locally. Mark Brown?
Mark Brown is one. And then from there, regionally, you'll be looking at the New Zealand government, so you're looking at aid funders.
So now, this is kind of a footnote, but it confused me for a while. Now, how long ago did the Cook Islands become a sovereign nation that wasn't under the governorship of New Zealand? Or has it always been? For some reason, I thought that, like, 15 years ago, this was it was part of New Zealand, like, geopolitically.
Well, you go back to around the 1860s, we became a protectorate, a British protectorate.
Yes.
And then officially, which is really the southern group of the 15 islands.
Okay.
Then the entire island became a protectorate around the 1880s. And then by 1900, after a lack of engagement from Britain on the protectorate, then protection was transferred over to New Zealand. So the Cook Islands became a protectorate of New Zealand.
Yes.
They became part of the New Zealand realm, along with Niue, Tokelau, and Samoa. In the 1960s, and this was a bit of a push from the United Nations around self-determination, Samoa went independent in the 60s. The Cook Islands, Tokelau, and Niue stayed part of the NZ realm. In 1965, the Cook Islands were able to have their own elections, and a special relationship was created with New Zealand, where the Cook Islands became a nation. It was a nation in self-determination, so they were able to self-govern, self-determination in association with New Zealand.
Yes.
So the Cook Islands became responsible for electing their own prime minister, having their own elections, electing their own cabinet, etc. Westminster system. But New Zealand had influence around internal affairs, foreign affairs, and security. And the way that they've leveraged that is through the relationship that we have with New Zealand around aid, around immigration, around trade, etc. So that relationship exists till today.
Yes.
So the Cook Islands exists as far as governing is concerned. We govern itself.
Let me ask you this. When did people here start having a Cook Islands passport instead of a New Zealand passport?
They don't have a Cook Islands passport.
What?
Yeah. So since they became a New Zealand protectorate, we've been New Zealand citizens.
Okay.
Citizens.
So I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that, but you are a separate country.
No,
I
mean, no. Well, we are.
Well,
I
had to leave New Zealand. I had to stamp out through immigration to come here.
And then
stamp in to come here.
Yeah.
And so it's like
a... So it is a special relationship
yes.
we have with New Zealand. Cook Islanders hold New Zealand passports.
And so can you just go to New Zealand, no questions asked, as if you're a...
All Cook Islanders have the same rights as New Zealanders.
So you don't have to show a passport. You go in as a resident, right?
People go in with a passport, but we are New Zealand citizens.
Okay.
So we all hold New Zealand passports.
So it's even in my early years down under, Kiwis didn't need a passport to go to Australia, but they changed that a few years ago.
But as Cook Islanders, being New Zealand citizens, we have the same rights as New Zealanders to actually work in Australia.
Yes.
So we have all the same rights.
See, but I think that's good.
Yeah, it's good. It's good on one side.
And what's the downside of it?
Well, we have the highest rate of depopulation in the world. So the majority of our population, we have around... The last elections here 6 months ago, there were around 10,000 registered voters. We probably have around 3,000 kids. It's a total population of around 13,000.
Are you talking about Rarotonga or the Cook Islands?
Cook Islands.
All both groups?
Yeah, both
really?
Groups. So we have 15 islands. The smallest populations in the islands is probably 50 to 60 on an island. The next largest island, Aitutaki, is around 1,200 to 1,300.
And you've got, what, about 6,000 people here?
Well, no, there's probably around 10.
Oh, the 10 was for Rera.
10 to 12,000 people on this island. The rest are all kind of spread in small groups around the outer islands.
How many dogs are there?
there's a lot of dogs.
How many chickens?
A lot of chickens.
Would there be as many as there are people? Or more?
No, look, and you know...
This is just a...
Well, you'll find a lot of chickens on the island.
I like them.
Yeah, but why we have a lot of chickens is because of the trade deficit.
Because people eat their eggs and stuff.
No, they import the chicken.
Do they?
Yeah, because it's imported. Why bother catching one?
Yeah, yeah.
So you'll see that the chicken numbers have gone up because you can go down the supermarket and you can buy a box of steroid-grown chicken pieces from the US. And so you'll find, you know, there are different factors around the island. We have the highest rated depopulation. Our Cook Island population in New Zealand is around 65,000. In Australia, we have around 20,000 Cook Islands in Australia.
And define what you mean by depopulation in this context.
So depopulation is just leaving the island.
Okay, so but you don't mean the genocide of people.
No, well, it's not the genocide.
That's kind of like... That word has that connotation in the world today.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, you know, all the eugenics and all that stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Depopulation is just through the loss of population.
Yes.
And it tends to be what's driving them is, well, it'll be economic factors, it'll be education as well, and just that brain drain. So and because of the fact that they do have a New Zealand passport, it allows them to do this.
Well, maybe the people that come from the Cook Islands to New Zealand are filling the gap of all the Kiwis that went to Australia.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yep,
they were. Look, there's other things because of the mining. So there was a big mining boom in Australia.
What a horrific way to employ yourself.
But throughout the Pacifics, there's a history throughout the whole Pacific Islands, right back to the 1860s with blackbirding.
Yeah. Now, explain exactly what that is. I've heard that expression, but...
Well, in the 1860s, there were factors such as... Well, there was whaling and sealing throughout the Pacific region.
Yes.
And then the whaling, as far as an enterprise was concerned, started to drop. There was less whales available.
Even more horrific than mining.
Yep. So this factor of whalers and sealers throughout the Pacific. But then factors such as the American Civil War, which was in 1861.
With the Yanks and the Confederates.
Yep. What that did is that basically, cut down the supply of slaves available, especially into South America.
So blackbirding was the same as slavery. Were people captured against their will?
Yeah.
Or were they like employed?
No, they were captured against their will.
I didn't know that's what that actually meant.
Yeah, so in the 1860s and really from 1862, after American Civil War, 1861 to 1865, there was a drought of slaves, and so they came into the Pacific looking for slaves.
To bring back to America?
Well, the slaves were pretty much going into Peru, for us in the Cook Islands.
Why Peru?
Our slaves, because in Peru they had the cotton fields and the maize fields, and they were taking slaves originally from the States. And so,
I didn't know that.
So because of this lack of slaves and because of... Actually, what happened is that the whalers turned towards slavery. So they would go into the Pacific, invite people into the hull for trading, and then they would close the hull.
Oh, my God.
Would,
that's just such a dark chapter that's really not over. Because, I mean, my own feeling is that the global financial system really is just a form of really ultra-high-tech slavery.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
In a lot of ways, in terms of it doesn't have to be like that, but in terms of who controls it and the dynamics of it and stuff. So in a way, we're all kind of like slaves to a degree.
Kind of, and so where we, the fact that it's been missing, yeah, and after the Industrial Revolution, after this corporate, as far as corporate powers, et cetera, is concerned, but I feel as though they're having, in some ways, had their day.
Yes.
Because of the way that the state of the environment, as far as the internet's concerned, as far as just the state of our planet's concerned, and as far as probably grassroots indigenous voices are concerned, I think corporates have had to change their way and realize.
Or at least put a lot of money into the PR to convince us that to make us think they've changed. But is it true that Iceland locked up a bunch of bankers, or was that just hearsay? Did you hear that story a year or two ago?
No, I didn't hear that story.
Anyway. But
I think bankers are being locked up.
Oh, my God.
Since the beginning of time.
That's funny.
Yeah.
But the blackbirding thing. So is that whole... That's it's a thing of the past, right?
Yeah, it's a thing.
Is there anywhere in the world that actually still goes on?
Well,
legal or illegal?
Yeah, now they talk about sex trade and sex trafficking, et cetera, that go on. Even through, we're talking now the vulnerability of developing societies, developing economies.
The vulnerability of developing societies.
Yeah.
Now, what about the expression third world?
Yeah.
What does that mean to you, or what does it really mean?
Well, when I look at third world, then I tend to think around the economic and social equity that exists in those environments. So the ability to have access to health,
yes,
good health, access to good education, access to justice.
Clean drinking water.
Clean drinking water, food, access to, so that's where I see when it goes to developing equal rights, women's rights, youth rights.
Well, what's the second world? Because I know the first world, I'm always saying my holiday home only has two bathrooms.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very upset. And, that's first world problems.
Yeah, yeah.
But what's the second world? I never have been clear on that.
Well, probably the second world is actually you're sitting in the second world.
Oh, okay.
So the Cook Islands.
Oh, but see, but that's a good analogy.
The Cook Islands is actually just... It's just passing now into and being recognized as a developed state.
Yes.
So before it was
Is there undeveloped and then developing, or is it just developing and then developed?
Well, there seems to be developing. So the Cook Islands was recognized as developing.
Yes.
A developing or underdeveloped country.
But can you put a cap on the develop? On the develop thing, because once it gets going, it gets kind of a momentum of its own. Imagine this place if it had a whole bunch of, if it was like Maui or something, filled with skyscrapers and shit.
Yeah.
Is that hopefully that's impossible that would ever happen?
Well, that comes down to the powers that be, the powers that be, and then we're also talking about. Political. So there'll be political, there will be economic influences that will determine the future, but hopefully the people can have more of a voice in that.
And that's where part of what you're doing.
Yeah, that's what we're doing. You talked about the internet. Well, we actually have fiber optic cable inside this building. We're
yes.
the only building on the island with fiber optic cable.
Well, that's good. So you're not using Wi-Fi.
Well, we use Wi-Fi, but the reason why we went to fiber optic cable because we see dialogue, global dialogue.
Yes.
Is important. We need to have a voice in the world.
But is that just giving you greater bandwidth? Is that the technological advantage of fiber optic?
It gives us greater bandwidth, but for us to actually compete, the other thing too is about us putting our content on the internet.
Yes.
And our content and feeding it to the globe rather than the other way around.
Yes.
And for us, really, the past has been about other people telling our stories.
Yes.
The future lies in us telling our own stories.
Absolutely.
Putting our own content out there and our own opinions and perspectives. And so having, being able to have, you need to be on the same level
the level playing field.
Same platform. And so having fiber optic cable in this building, puts us in, at least we're kind of on a technical level. We're
yes.
able to kind of get the same and send the same data back again.
Well, do you have sort of like your own TV and or radio studio here or station?
We don't, but we've worked in the area of capacity building local storytellers.
Yes.
So we created a model. We created something called Film Raro. And so Film Raro is where we invited filmmakers from around the world to come here and to capacity build locals to tell their own story. So we talk about digital preservation of language heritage or the preservation of language heritage and culture in the digital format and educating our people, giving them the capacity to do that.
Yes.
So that they can tell their own stories and basically preserve their own identity.
Just backtracking for a second,
yeah.
I wanted to ask you, who of these sort of bureaucratic or corporate entities or organizations might have an eye on this place in the sense of stuff that they'd like to see happen here? For example, the multi-story condos and high-end resorts and stuff like that. And also, I was going to talk with you about the environmental stuff later, but I know this place is really on the radar for the deep seabed mining people.
Yeah. And you're talking about on the radar as far as the whole island or the Pacific's concerned.
Well, both, but specifically here.
Well, so the Pacific region now is more topical than it ever has been at any time in history. And that's got to do with climate change, the state of the ocean, pollution, plastics pollution, etc. It's also got to do with their, you know, in some ways the last stocks of mineral resource or marine resources existing in the Pacific. And then the other factor of security. So as far as global concern,
who would you need to be secure from?
So, the Chinese are now pushing into the Pacific in a big way. So their strategies around the whole trade, etc. So because the Chinese are pushing into the Pacific in a big way, that's woken the Americans to look at the interests in the Pacific. And because of the Americans having an interest in the Pacific, then that's also woken the obligations of New Zealand and Australia as far as, in some ways, being the advocate for America and the Pacific region.
Well, have you heard the expression, the Pacific pivot?
Yeah. And there's and other factors from UNESCO, United Nations, having interest in the Pacific. So the Pacific is actually full of a lot of people interested in the Pacific region at the moment.
Thomas, our friend who you met, he said he was talking with somebody, I think that worked for Blue Sky, and they said that there was actually somebody from America was here talking with the Blue Sky people about the necessity of being able to protect their undersea cable.
Yeah. Yep. So,
do you know who that was? Or
Yeah. I had a meeting with them too.
What was his? I won't ask for his name, but what was his position? Was he from the military?
So that was the FBI.
Okay, for real?
Yeah.
So they're involved with stuff like that.
Cybersecurity unit.
Okay.
So yeah.
Well, you know what corporation handles American cybersecurity? Lockheed.
Yeah. Yeah. So and that's why security has become a big issue in the Pacific region with things like. Fiber optic cable coming into the Pacific.
But who would? Who would the enemy be?
Well, they each see each other as an enemy. So, be it from. As I mentioned, all those players, they all have their own interests in the region. So they're all wanting. They're all looking for an edge over and above each other. And so,
but you know what I found interesting? My friend who's a marine biologist in Kauai, Hawaii, he's very intimately related with the military there.
Yeah.
And he told me his brother actually owns a defense contracting firm that does highly classified electronics manufacturing. And he made it clear to me that almost all the countries in the world, possibly even China and Russia, they all have sonars and microwave weapons and stuff made by the same corporations, Lockheed, Boeing, Raytheon.
Yeah, right.
And so they're really, the corporations, you can't call it trading with the enemy.
Yeah, well.
Because it's not really the enemy.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? I mean, it's a complex world.
It's a complex world. There's been research into the fishing industry, and they've traced a lot of fishing industry back to corporations, which are not even in the fishing industry.
But it goes back to what we were talking about yesterday about how the banks or private foundations or the Navy, they can create all kinds of intermediate foundations and front companies and that can buy this and control that and donate money and do all this stuff. And people may and or may not know who they're actually dealing with. But, I mean, if we actually knew the reality of the scope of all that kind of stuff, people would probably be shocked at, like, who owns the biggest fishing companies, which are really out of control in New Zealand right now.
So our way of kind of getting around that is that what we tend to do is that, so as an organization, what we do is we create sustainable models,
yes.
Development models,
You mean like as a computer simulation or on paper, conceptually?
Yeah, yeah. So we'll create models of development.
Yes.
And so our thing is around Pacifica. So models of development that develop Pacific people, the Pacific region.
Yes.
And so for us, we've been in it for a long time, so we can research the model. We know the pluses, the minuses. We know where the benefits will come.
Yes.
And our thing is actually our thing is going in and working with organizations who will actually help us to fulfill those models.
Yes,
and so
even if that meant restraining the reason that your company exists, like for example, the purse seining, fishing and stuff.
But for us, we will research the organization and not be.
So you wouldn't deal with somebody, But what if even the fact that you wouldn't deal with them, but their presence is still being felt? How does that figure in?
Well, and so we've worked in scenarios like that, exactly that scenario. For us, and then we've been approached in the past through tobacco companies offering funding.
What was their agenda? Just as a market, or did they want to grow it here or something like that?
Well, what they wanted was political leverage, and they knew that associating with us with certain models that we created, because we were working in government sectors and the community, that they knew that they could have some political influence by associating with us. So they would come to us with money, lots of money, and this is the tobacco industry, and also from the alcohol industry we've approached. But for us, we're taking those factors, as I said, business acumen, culture, community, and the environment.
Did they bring some beads and blankets?
Well,
you know what I'm saying?
Yep, but it's a business relationship, so they were offering them in a very formal business way. But for us, as far as our philosophy and integrity was concerned, at the end of the day, and this is how we build our own philosophy.
Yes.
We need to have integrity.
Yes.
Not just how we run our business, but for our people as well.
Absolutely. Well, and so now tell me this. How you've been doing this project for a couple of years, right?
Yeah. But I've been working in the sector over 35 years.
For real. Well, so do you have much awareness or feedback on how the outside global, the geopolitical, bureaucratic, or corporate community is looking at you?
Yeah.
How much they're aware of you, and how do they think of you as friend or foe, or someone to be an ally, to be to work with, or someone to be wary of, or sort of all of the above, probably.
Well, generally, what happens is that a lot of these larger organizations, corporates, governments, etc., agencies, they will come in with a perception of who we are and what we are. So they'll come in with, in some ways, a stereotype.
Yes.
And so for us, our thing is actually being able to turn that around and dispel their stereotypes and actually talk to them about who we really are and what we really can offer them.
And that's probably you usually doing that, you yourself, right?
Yeah. Yep.
See, but you're good, man. You're really good at
But for me, I go back to my integrity. We go back to your basic, your mission statement. And I'm a Pacific person, and this is something I've learnt over my life. And at the end of the day, I'm here to serve my people and serve my community.
Yes.
And so
and all the non-human life forms too.
Yep, exactly. Which is, and that's what I talk about, my environment and my culture and my community. And as a Pacific person, I understand what that means to serve my people and serve my community. And at the end of the day, how I judge my work, etc., is by my interaction with my community.
Well, I was just telling Thomas that one of my favorite quotes from the Bible, I think it's a proverb that's just come to my mind so many times in recent months, "By their fruits you shall know them."
Yeah.
And see, isn't that cool? Because it's not what people say.
Yeah.
It's the fruits of their actions or inactions, It's like that's the reality.
Yeah. And this is something I've learned over time, I'm not a young person anymore, and,
Well, how old are you? 35?
55.
Oh, what? No way.
Yeah, I'm 55.
Dude, you look at least 20 years younger than that. I'm serious.
Well, maybe because I have a good philosophy in life.
Congratulations.
Yeah. I know, so, you know, I do. I try to live for now, I say that I live in service.
Yes.
And I live to really serve the community. I try to make moral, decisions with integrity.
Yes.
And
from your heart.
And from
my heart. You have a very powerful heart chakra. But you do.
Yeah, like I say, I kind of, for me, it's instinctive as far as knowing at the end of the day and looking past myself at something bigger than me and knowing that hopefully I'm making decisions that are of benefit, you know.
And a lot of times you may be involved in stuff that you don't know when you might ever see the result of it, and you have to sort of hope that you're actually being guided in the highest possible way.
Yeah.
You know?
A friend of mine and I, we talk about chasing rainbows.
Yes.
And at the end of the day, you can chase the rainbows, but you've still got to, take the step, dig the hole, move.
Absolutely. But you know what's funny about a rainbow is a lot of them are actually, they're literally just right there. It's not even far away.
Yeah.
It's like this optical. The light is actually at your fingertips.
Yeah. You know, even in the Pacific, we talk about rainbows, and for us, rainbows are significant because they can signify either a beginning of life or passing of life.
Yes. Well, I love rainbows. The ancient Maori name is Aniwaniwa.
Yeah.
Do you know that?
Yeah.
For real. Well, do you know much of the Cook Island Maori? Is that the main language, or there's actually quite a few different dialects among even just the Cook Islands, right?
Yeah, many dialects amongst the Cook Islands.
Do you know any of those?
No.
Bits and pieces?
Bits and pieces.
But do you know the name? But that's cool that you know Aniwaniwa.
Yeah, so for me, I'm a Cook Islander. I'm in New Zealand. I'm a Polynesian born in New Zealand.
Yes.
So I was brought up. My parents came to the Pacific, to New Zealand, for a better life, for their kids, etc. And also, too, within the Pacific, what happens is that a lot of land gets split up and split up and split up, and then they separate the family land and becomes a little economical as far as living off the land is concerned. So they look for another life, look for a better life, and New Zealand opened the doors around after the Second World War. They were looking for a lot of development. A lot of Pacific Islanders were encouraged to work in the factories and help kind of, build New Zealand up after the Second World War. So my parents were there for a better life. But very much for them, their culture was very much shunned upon. So the next generation coming up, they encouraged us not to really to learn our culture or learn our language.
Yes, that's the age-old story.
Yeah. Our culture wasn't in the curriculum, our culture wasn't in the language. So then now I have two sons, and so now it's important for me that they can reconnect to who they are and what they are. Yeah.
They could be electric, those quads.
They're probably imported from China.
Sure. Well, let me ask you this. Technically, what's the difference between Polynesia and Melanesia? It's strictly geographical, not cultural, right?
It's cultural.
Is it?
Well, yeah. So,
this is just for my own information.
Yeah. If we go back to the migration, the Polynesian navigator, wayfinder, voyager, so over a 5,000-year period, they were able to populate the Pacific Ocean.
And where, did they come from South America?
No, coming down actually from Asia.
Okay.
So they actually came down from Asia. So all the evidence from linguistic to DNA, archaeological evidence, shows that they actually came down from Asia. Over a 5,000-year period, they were able to populate the Pacific Ocean. But through that population period, they needed to develop methodology around navigation.
Yes.
And technology.
They're the master navigators.
Yeah. So they regard them as the world's greatest navigators, and the vessel, the Vaka, is the world's greatest navigation or voyaging vessel in the world.
Have you heard of a guy named David Lewis?
I think so.
You might be interested. He's a Kiwi guy that wrote these books about Polynesian navigation techniques.
So as far as the navigators are concerned, not only did they develop this methodology and this technology, but they also developed their own religion,
yes,
which is very much based around these elements that guided them. So, like the Greeks, so it was around the gods in the ocean, the gods in the air, the gods in the wind, our ancestors in the animals.
The planets, the storms. Poseidon.
Yeah, yeah.
Or, but I love that stuff.
Papatūānuku.
Yes.
Tangaroa, yes. So those are all our gods. And for us too, as far as Pacific people, I recently had a discussion with a pastor that came through, and he said, well, they must have been really brave. But for me, bravery belittles the science that they had and the technology, the advancement. So it wasn't so much about bravery for them as the fact that they
knew what they were doing.
They were master navigators. They knew what they were doing. They didn't just trust it to the gods. They didn't just trust it to the gods.
But that might have helped.
But they also had developed a faith. And so for them, as we were discussing, for them, faith and spirituality wasn't just on the Sunday. For them, spirituality and faith was 24/7.
But and how could it not be?
Exactly. So they woke up in the morning, from waking in the morning to eating, to sleeping, to planting, to fishing. Everything was amongst their faith and based on their faith.
Every moment is sacred.
Every moment in my life. Yeah. And so we talk about that spirituality that they had, and the fact that that spirituality was part of what drove them to be the voyagers, to be the navigators, to understand that their gods were in the ocean and their ancestors were in the animals of the ocean, and that gave them the faith to drive further forward and forward.
And did they have an ultimate destination? Like, did they finally go, oh, we're finally there? Because apparently Hawaiki had kind of that.
It wasn't a final destination. Hawaiki was a place where you would come from. So your spirituality was based in Hawaiki.
Okay.
So, and the other thing is that the life was cyclical.
Yes.
You come from Hawaiki, you go back to Hawaiki
as
well. So, and Hawaiki was not up, it was down. So
yes.
It was in the ocean.
Okay.
It was in the earth. It was in the underworld was Hawaiki.
Very cool.
So, yeah. So this is part of what motivated them as well to voyage and to discover. And really they went as far as, and they were pushed to by overpopulation, lack of resources, and the fact that they had the technology and they had the methodology to go further and further. So they were discoverers as much as anything else.
Well, so they were probably just as good at getting where they were going and knowing where they were as James Cook. In a different way.
Well, they say better, actually. So for them, they were very much guided by nature, at one with nature.
Did they make maps?
Yeah.
Were they cognitive maps, which I think the whales and dolphins have? A holographic acoustic maps in their head.
Yeah, exactly. So for them as specific people, they have things where they, and initially coming out of Micronesia and Melanesia, they developed things such as stick charts. And stick charts were charts where they used shells and sticks, and the shells depicted the islands, and then what they did is they bent the sticks around the island to depict the currents.
Yes.
Or the refraction of currents.
And so this would be something they would lay out like on a flat surface.
This is something that they would actually create, the actual size.
Like on sand or something? Or
They would build these out of sticks and shells.
Do you have any, is there photos of any of these available?
Yeah.
Really? That's very cool.
So they sit in museums around the world. But that's an example of primary navigation techniques, methodology, the stick charts. But from there, moving on, the stick charts were in Micronesia, they were in Melanesia, but they never got to Polynesia, because by the time they got to Polynesia, the navigators were celestial navigators.
Yes.
And also, our language was passed orally. And the way that our social structure was concerned, we had vaults of information that were kept in the minds of taonga, either priests or people that actually kept knowledge around lineage or chants or dance, and that's the way that we transferred the information.
And so they transferred it orally, and that was part of an initiation, the ability of someone to prove that they can recite it properly?
Well, so there were different elements or different factors, selection processes, where certain individuals are selected or inherited rights, etc., toward these skills. But then, of course, you had to display those skills as well. So there was this factor of mentoring, this factor of apprenticeship that existed as well within the culture. It strongly existed within the culture. And the thing of ancestors as well, the relevance of ancestors is very, very strong as well. So that's that understanding of the knowledge and the past knowledge and the knowledge And for Pacific people, then the understanding of past, present, and future. So,
Explain. Well, for example, I was studying about linguistics when I was in college, and there was he was an amateur anthropologist that was the first outside person to live with the Hopi Native Americans,
yeah.
And he started studying their language and stuff, and he was freaked out because one of his initial observations was that their whole language didn't seem to have any tenses.
Yeah.
They didn't divide it up into past, present, and future. Everything was now.
Yeah.
It might have been distant in space,
but
the time factor was all simultaneous. And that's so different from the West, from the English.
Yeah. And so that existed too within the Pacific culture, which is why, you know, this element of spirituality existed as well. So, yeah, birth, life, death, afterlife. So understanding that those worlds all exist in one...
it was all here
one reality. So, so then we talk about, now we're talking about this transfer of knowledge and how they were able to transfer the knowledge. And they transfer the knowledge, orally, dance, chant, etc., through apprenticeships, and then in some ways creating certain classes as well, so having a priesthood. Within the Pacific,
were the priests also the navigators?
Yeah, so they say.
So that was like the highest and most relevant knowledge that you could possess.
Yeah.
They were astronomers. They would have become astronomers.
Yeah. So they say that the spiritual center of Polynesia is an island off Tahiti called Raiatea.
Can you spell that?
Oh, Raiatea.
Raiatea.
Yeah,
I've never heard of
Raiatea. Raiatea, just off Tahiti, and there's a marae there called Taputapuatea. So they say this is the spiritual center of Polynesia. And from that center is where they educated their priests. And the priests were brought from young boys. They were selected and they were taught. They were taught in the knowledge of their ancestors as far as the spirituality was concerned, but they were also taught in the vaka, because the vaka was very much a part of their spirituality as well.
And what does that mean? Is that W-A-K-A?
Different for different places.
Because in one sense it means a boat, right?
Or So there's the waka, which is the New Zealand word for a double hull canoe, or
yes.
The waka, ocean going, which is here in this Pacific region, and there are other words for it throughout the Pacific. But for them it was very much part of their spirituality, so they say they educated them in the waka as well, and then from there they were able to continue their navigation or discovery up through Hawaii, then onto the west coast of America.
Yes.
Then down through Easter Island, and then onto the west coast of South America.
Really?
And then down to New Zealand as well.
Traveling by boat is a very good metaphor for our life journey. And the rudder and navigation and all this stuff. And it's the Egyptian cosmology, as I've come to understand it, traveling in boats was a very central metaphor that they used a lot too.
Yeah, well, there was a lot of the spirituality that was embodied into the waka. Everything in its design, etc., based on, again, everything was around the spirituality of faith that they lived. An example is that, and I was having a discussion recently with a Maori carver who actually carves canoe, or kind of carves the waka. And we were discussing this modern era of wakas that are traveling around the globe at the moment, initiated first from the Hokulea period. And now these vakas that are traveling around, we were talking about a certain ceremony when they arrived in different countries. One of the ceremonies where the crew of the vaka would take a stone, and then they would give the stone as a gift to the local people. So we were just having discussions around where the ceremony may have started or where it came from. And we were talking about the consciousness of this. And for the carver and I, we discussed and thought that probably it's not something that our ancestors actually did. It's probably a modern
embellishment
of this gift-giving ceremonial thing.
But it's not a bad idea.
It's not a bad idea, but for us, where we see it...
You want to stick to the way it really was?
Well, we're thinking back of how it would have been traditionally, and we think traditionally, probably more appropriately, is that first, when you arrive on a waka, there's no one to give the stone to anyway. because it's new.
And plus, you never know. Even if you did, they might be suspicious of it.
They could be, but and we're talking about the first navigators, the first voyages, and where this would have come from.
Yes.
But ceremonially, the marae, or the religious or spiritual place of meeting, the marae is made out of stones.
Are they?
Yep. So they took a stone from the marae, which we understand, and the stone was placed under the mast or by the mast.
Ah.
And so by doing that, the marae is a place where the living connect to their ancestors and their gods.
It's like a portal.
Yeah. Any decisions that are made on the marae are made in association with your ancestors and the gods.
Well, I've never heard it explained that way, but that makes a lot of sense.
So when they take a stone from the marae,
all those spirits and ancestors are imbued. They're connected with that. So but I feel that way about rocks.
And when you put it onto the vaka becomes the marae.
And it's mobile.
Yeah.
But that's so cool. But you know, I believe that rock is the body of Mother Earth.
Yeah.
So it really, we've got it's a marae for the whole, for all of Mother Earth and all of the life forms that have ever lived here.
Yeah. And so from that, they've transferred the marae, they've brought their ancestors and their gods with them onto the vaka.
What better guides could you have?
Exactly.
That's really cool, man.
And then when you arrive in a new land,
they're there with you.
You take that stone,
yes,
and you place it on the new land. And by doing that, then you're placing your ancestors that have journeyed with you, and you've created a place with your ancestors and your gods.
Well, and then ultimately, you already had ancestors that was from there anyway, because it's all part of the earth.
Yeah.
See, but how different is that from putting the flag of your country?
Yeah, yeah. And how different is that than the ceremonies that you're doing today, where they arrive and they give a stone to the local?
Is that what they're doing?
Yeah, which is okay. We were just discussing the validity of the ceremony.
Yeah.
You know, and it'd probably be the... So this is more out
there. It's the Hollywood version.
Yeah. Well, I think it's more the Western commercial version, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
I arrive, you know, I've got to bring a gift, so here's a gift, just like Christmas.
But the rocks I gave you weren't... I wasn't thinking anything like that.
Yeah. So
it's just a personal, personal thing.
Well, which is, you know, we talk about this as well. You embody yourself and us and your ancestors. And
I want people to be stunned.
And so, yeah. So this is. So we talk about the spirituality and the transfer of knowledge and the transfer of spirituality. So what I've been discussing is just an example of that transfer of knowledge, spirituality that existed for these people. And then how that changed, and you talk about where they journey, and yes, they were journeying, and they were journeying through that discovery. There was pressures that pushed them to go further, but there was also that belief and faith to go further and further. And then, you know, what changed it was when the missionaries and Europeans came through. That's when things changed.
And all made possible by James Cook.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing is the journey back is a different journey too, because the journey back, and these people were trading backwards and forwards, it wasn't one direction.
Yes.
And very much they were building societies, they were building kingdoms, they were building dynasties and tribes. So through human nature, the journey back was a lot different journey. And then the next thing too is then when the Europeans arrived, and that was a major factor that changed the region as well.
Well, but before we go into that, let me ask you about the whales and dolphins, both from your own personal perspective and how, in the context of what we're talking about here, anyone that lived on the ocean would have been very intimately related with the whales and dolphins. And I told you that story yesterday about how that was related to me by Rodney Nowakot, the leader of the Iwi on Great Barrier Island, that Arafaro, the high priest of the Takatimu Waka, was guided across the ocean by 7 white whales. He brought him exactly to where he wanted to go.
Yeah.
And I thought that was so cool, and I believe it.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like you know, what was the basic attitude? Because there's so many whales and dolphins. I mean,
So when we go back to the spirituality and the fact that, you know, for our people, they very much embodied their spirituality into the environment. The environment also, you know, also concerning the marine animal environment as well. I mean, for them, that's where sustenance came out of that environment. This is what fed them. And this is also where tools, etc., came from there. So for them, they were gifts to them as well. But also, not only were they gifts as far as sustenance was concerned, but they were also guides for them. One example is the fact that even we talk about navigation and development of navigation and population Pacific region, if we look at the element of birds and bird migrations, just the fact for us for a person or a navigator to be in the water fishing, a fisherman, and one day to see a flock of birds fly over his head in the opposite direction, and then to see that happen another day and another day, this person's not stupid.
They would know that the birds would probably go onto land.
They knew those birds were going somewhere. And having the knowledge and the technology, why wouldn't they try to follow them? And why wouldn't they push further and further? So within those birds, then you can see there's a certain element, and eventually when they were able to regularly map the path and follow the path of these birds, and the birds became a part of their whole spirituality, and
yes,
then they would embody the ancestors and the birds as well.
It was spirituality rooted in common sense.
Yeah, spirituality and rooted in nature, and,
yes,
you know, in human nature, and the, creating the connection as well. And so, and from the birds also, and the animals and, you know, cetaceans as well. So following whales, knowing that there are migratory paths, and there are times of years that these animals will come up and that they will go down. Having our whales, humpback whales, that are actually feeding Antarctica, and they'll come up to mate and calf throughout the Pacific region. They'll come up around June, July, up until October.
This is on your way to Antarctica?
This is on their way away from
Antarctica. Oh, okay. Oh, yeah, because...
coming into the Pacific to mate and calf, and then at the end of the mating season, the calfing season, then taking and then going back to Antarctica.
In the summer.
In the summer. And so we were discussing that fact of, so we know that they have a migratory path, and we know that that migratory path actually comes across New Zealand too.
Yes.
So for them to travel and then to actually see the connection, and actually before that, actually embodying a certain amount of faith in these animals too, you can see how the relationship and how they connect themselves to the whales as far as guides for them, you know, spiritual guides for them.
Totemic totems.
But the other thing too is that another thing that we looked into was the number of whales that would have been in the ocean at the time that they voyaged would have been far greater than what we are now. We looked at some of the reports of whaling in the area, especially around the period that the Russians came down, the Russians were whaling.
Before that, you could look out and just see them for all the way to the horizon, right?
Yeah. So it would have been the fact that we look at these logs, and we look at the whaling logs, and we see that thousands and hundreds of thousands of whales that they took out of the area. Today, when we, you know, we work with the whales here, today we can follow them, you know, from their blows, etc., but also through their song, so we can hear their song through the hull. And to think that it, back in those days of our ancestors, the hundreds of thousands more that would have been in the water, the easier it would have been for them to actually follow them, actually to be a part of their pods and to hear their singing in the night, etc. So to understand that, yes, why wouldn't they have been guided? Why couldn't they have, you know, been a part of it?
In the world of today, the whales are having a hard time hearing themselves at all.
Yeah.
And we're living in a world with technologies where whaling, you know, would target like one whale at a time.
Yeah.
And still in a lot of people's mind, that's like the most barbaric thing, but it's not the reality, because we both know that there's like technologies that, for example, low-frequency sonar, this is even just old-school stuff, seismic testing, one blast can probably kill hundreds or thousands of whales, depending on the location, at once.
Yeah.
Or deafen them, damage them in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And so nowhere in the ocean is safe from all this stuff.
Yeah.
But at least that's one thing that I think you're really lucky in the Cook Islands, that you've got, as far as I know, except for the occasional visitor from a weapons laboratory, you've got zero military presence here. Is there any? Have you ever known of any submarines coming around here? I mean, not that you'd know, because that's why they're down there. But does New Zealand ever send any vessels out here?
Yeah. So, you know, part of protecting the region is the fact that we need we need surveillance. The Pacific is the Wild Wild West, right now?
Well, the ocean, yeah, the especially ocean. Outside of anyone's EEZ.
Yeah. Oh, it's not outside.
Except for the United Nations.
It's in the EEZ. It's the Wild Wild West. So here today, throughout the Pacific, is the Wild Wild West.
Yes.
We're facing raiders every day.
Are there any Wyatt Earps? He was a sheriff,
yeah.
Wasn't he?
Yeah.
A gunslinging sheriff.
Yeah.
But I don't know.